Hello and welcome to the Promise Institute podcast. We are the home for human rights here at the UCLA School of Law, and I am Natalie Monsanto, the Institute's Communications and Development Manager. In this episode, you'll hear Catherine Sweetser, our Deputy Director, as she introduces and moderates a panel from our 2021 symposium about international human rights and corporate accountability. If you'd like to watch the speakers or to see the other discussions from our symposium, head over to our YouTube channel. We're easy to find. Just search for the Promise Institute for Human Rights. Without further ado, here's Catherine kicking off the discussion.
Hello, everyone. My name is Catherine Sweetser, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Promise Institute for Human Rights. I'm so happy to be here today to introduce this panel of four amazing litigators. We're going to talk about their work on holding corporations accountable for transnational harms. I'll first introduce Agnieszka Frisman. She's a partner at Cohen Milstein, where she chairs the firm's human rights practice. She focuses on cases of torture, human trafficking, forced labor, and other violations of international law. She previously earned the National Law Journal Pro Bono Award for her efforts on behalf of Nepali laborers injured or killed at U.S. military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. The brief she drafted on behalf of a number of members of Congress in the Doe versus Nestle case is available at the link on the symposium website. Our next panelist is Miriam Sajamas. She's the Vice Legal Director at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, where she chairs their Business and Human Rights Program. She has worked on various cases against corporations, including civil proceedings against German retailer Kik regarding labor exploitation in South Asia. At the written materials link on the symposium website, there's a forthcoming article by Dr. Sajamas, which discusses not only the role of transnational litigation, but also the role of lawyers and community partners in building transnational alliances. The next panelist is Marissa Valsing, who is a supervising attorney at Earth Rights International. Her focus is on legal strategies to defend the human and environmental rights of communities. She helped launch ERI's new Amazon office in Lima, Peru, where she is developing an Amazon legal program supporting indigenous communities affected by resource extraction. Some of her other litigation in federal court includes Doe versus Chiquita Brands, Campos Alvarez versus Newmont Mining, Manise versus Thompson Safaris, and Minas versus Occidental. Our last panelist is Mona Lisa, who is an international human rights lawyer from India. She's worked on a number of transnational lawsuits, including one against Syngenta that she's going to talk about today. She previously worked for the ECCHR and for the Special Tribunal in Lebanon, and she has an LLM from the University of Notre Dame. Welcome to all of our panelists. I'll turn it over to Agnieszka first to give an overview of some law and the work that she's been doing.
Thanks, Kathy. And I wanted to start off by saying how glad I am that Miriam and Mona Lisa are on the panel, because I think as American lawyers, sometimes we get stuck on this idea of American exceptionalism, or that, you know, our law is the center of the universe. But it's really turned out that we're way behind where other countries are. The European Union has fantastic jurisdictional provisions. There are lawyers in England and in the Netherlands and France who are bringing great cases on corporate liability and winning them. And I started the ExxonMobil case against ExxonMobil for wrongdoing in Indonesia using Indonesian law 21 years ago when my first child was born. That case is still muttering its way through US courts, and then using the same legal theories that we were developing there, lawyers have gone on and won in the United Kingdom and established the principle that corporations can be liable for the acts of their subsidiaries. And lawyers in the Netherlands have won, lawyers in Canada have won, and it's just not really the case that we're the center of the legal universe on corporate liability. I was thinking back to my very first case that I litigated, which is the Holocaust cases on behalf of forced and slave laborers who worked during World War II. And we won, we settled, we got $10 billion in Deutschmarks and reparations for over a million people in over, I think, 140 countries. And kind of what's interesting about that case is that it's one of those notorious foreign cube cases that the Supreme Court now says should never have been brought, you can't bring in the United States at all, and is really terrible, and like a example of law gone horribly awry. And you could never bring that case now because it's extraterritorial and the defendants are overseas, which is really a shame because obviously Holocaust era forced and slave labor was terrible, and those victims who suffered and never got any compensation in the interim should have been compensated well before we brought that lawsuit. So there are a lot of challenges ahead for people who are thinking of bringing those cases today. So I just wanted to start with things that, I mean, I think it's just the impetus is to be super creative about what law you use. One of the things I think we often overlook is foreign law. The case I mentioned earlier about Exxon relies on Indonesian law. We started off using the Alien Tort Statute Act, and the Alien Tort Statute claims were thrown out, but we're going forward with the same, largely the same claims, the same cause, the same incidents, the same wrongdoing against Exxon using Indonesian law of negligence and assault and battery and respondeat superior. And choice of law will often point to foreign law, and you can bring those cases in our courts using the foreign law of where the tort occurred. I have a case now against KBR Halliburton where we're also using foreign law. It's a case involving men in Nepal who thought they were going to work at hotels in Jordan. Instead, they were taken to Jordan, locked up in a small chamber, a locked room, and then driven across the desert overnight and brought to U.S. military bases in Iraq, where they went on a hunger strike, protested that they weren't supposed to be there, but their passports had been taken. They had no way to get home, and they alleged that they were held in forced labor for a couple of years before they were permitted to leave. And that case, like the Nestle case that you heard about earlier, was brought before the trafficking victim extraterritoriality provision kicked in. So we brought it under the Alien Tort Statute, under Iraqi law, which incorporates international law, and under Texas state law. I did another case in Iraq where we used the Defense Base Act. It was Iraqi translators who were killed while working for the Americans, and then they were defrauded out of their benefits by the American insurer. And we used the Defense Base Act, an insurance fraud statute, to get a full recovery for the men. So sometimes it's not like the big deal human rights statutes that can get recovery for your clients. It's kind of bedrock fraud and negligence and assault and battery claims that you can use. And then the last set of cases that I've worked on, also a case I worked on with Kathy, is the Ratha case involving Cambodian men and women who were trafficked to work in a shrimp factory in Thailand. They allegedly were trafficked to work for a shrimp factory in Thailand. And I also brought a seafood slavery case where men from Indonesia were wanted to work on his fishing vessel. So they got on the boat and then they were offloaded onto a smaller boat where they were held against their will and forced to fish for tuna under terrible conditions until they're fortuitously for them jumped ship in the world's best jurisdiction if you were going to jump ship for jurisdictional purposes in the Northern District of California. And so we, under both those cases, we use the Trafficking Victims Protection Act to sue for those workers, which is a terrific statute that you heard a lot about earlier. But so in short, like to succeed in this area, you really have to be creative. You have to look at other statutes, other provisions, and other laws that might apply. But I think the cases are possible and worth doing. So that's what we got.
Thank you so much, Agnieszka. Next, I think Miriam is going to talk a little bit about her work in Europe.
Yes, thank you. Well, first of all, also thank you so much for inviting me. I think when we founded ECCHR in 2008, we were really looking at the U.S. litigation as an inspiration, especially also the litigation that you've started against corporations. And I do think, you know, while I would not share the view of American exceptionalism, I do still think that the litigation that you've started against transnational corporations has been really setting on the pace of, you know, others following in European jurisdictions, but obviously also elsewhere. You know, if you think about the Chevron litigation in Ecuador and so on. So I think, you know, anyways, so I think historically it's the litigation that has started in the US has been really important. I really liked what Agnieszka just said about the necessity of being creative. I think that is clearly true for continental Europe. Because if you look at law, if you look at commercial law, if you look at company law, you know, all that is geared towards is that multinational companies at their headquarters are not supposed to be responsible for what is happening in their supply chains or in their, you know, at their sites of production, their subsidiaries. It's just really not meant to be. What they do, they create irresponsibility. It's outsourcing risks. It's outsourcing, you know, obligations that, and you know, that normally would be attributed through labor law to a factory owner, no? And now multinational corporations don't have their own factories anymore. They are outsourced. So at ECCHR, we're based in Germany and in Berlin, but we do try to also, you know, our aim, as we call ourselves European, is to also, you know, work with other lawyers and other European jurisdictions. And So we are, you know, trying to use a mix of, we do some civil litigation, which is in continental Europe, not necessarily the classic way to go, but we have been bringing a case against a German retailer that has been the main buyer of from a factory in Pakistan. This factory burned down, 250 people died, and we were helping and representing four Pakistani family members and one surviving worker in a German court. And they made, you know, a classic tort claim to say we're asking the company to pay compensation for the pain and suffering of losing our, you know, a lot of times one of the most important breadwinners of the family. By that, because of jurisdictions, and actually not a problem, but because of conflicts of interest law, we needed to apply Pakistani law. And that's actually, you know, as also Agnesha said, that's a lot of times we do in those cases, you do apply foreign law. And we were drawing our arguments from the UK jurisprudence that had been building up until then on parent corporate liability, as Pakistan is a former common law jurisdiction. And so we made the argument, you know, you need to transfer this precedence from the UK also onto the supply chain relationships. Another case we did is we're also using criminal law, as this is, especially in France and Germany, a very classic route to go. So together with French lawyers and French organization Sherpa, we have been representing victims that have been working in a Syrian factory, a subsidiary of the French Swiss a cement company, Lafarge-Holcim. And we've been representing them in French courts, alleging that Lafarge headquarters, both the company as such, the corporate entity, as well as individual managers, are responsible for a financing of terrorism, but also, and that was from our point of view, the most important argument, saying aiding and abetting war crimes against humanity committed by the civil war parties and especially by ISIS. This is a remarkable and important case because it has led to serious investigations and to indictments. We are right now in appeal before the Supreme Court on the indictment of aiding and abetting crimes against humanity. The other indictments are held up. So we are battling this and also our status of a partie civile. As an NGO, you can also be part of the criminal trial. But definitely the survivors the witnesses are partie civile, so they will stay in this trial and be represented by lawyers. Another really important aspect, I think, what's currently happening in Europe and which is very interesting is that there's much debate about legislating mandatory creating mandatory human rights due diligence obligations for companies. Using the UN guiding principles in this concept of human rights due diligence and actually putting this into law. There, France has been the front rower, and we're bringing a case with a Mexican organization, Prodesk, on behalf of the community Unión Hidalgo in Mexico. And this law is quite big, and we are saying while the company has not yet even actually started building their wind park, we say they have already violated their human rights due diligence obligation because they have not been respecting the community's right to free, prior, informed consent. It's an indigenous community. And so that is quite remarkable. While this is a very new law, and it's one we have one of, I think, five or other lawsuits that are trying this law out now. But I think it has quite some potential. And Germany, where also there's just 3 weeks ago, there's been a law proposal coming out by the government, creating a similar law. It has, you know, we need to see, it has a couple of flaws. And still, you know, if those laws would come, we would actually finally have something like a little bit of a clearer venue. I don't want to compare to the Alien Torts Claims Act because it's really completely different on how it's structured, but somehow a law that actually fits to the situation, you know, that is sort of meant to capture what's the problem. That's quite interesting. And at the same time, while on Germany there's a struggle, the same goes on at the European level. So at the European Commission, they're definitely going to come out with a legislative proposal, which then would have to be transformed by all member states. So basically, the discussion will be on for the next 5 years. And at the moment, I'm quite hopeful that we will get some kind of legislation that we can, you know, at least use creatively. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Miriam. I'll hand it over now to Marissa to talk a little bit about the work that she's been doing on behalf of communities.
Thanks so much, Kathy, and thanks everyone. I'm really honored to be here among these panelists. So as Kathy mentioned, I've been working for many years on the Doe v. Chiquita case, in which Aneshka is actually my co-counsel, so she should chime in if I, you know, forget any important elements here. But I actually, looking at the attendees list, I think a number of you out there have also helped us over the years on that case. It's been going on a while, like many of these cases do. And I think, you know, one thing we've learned in that case is that it's really important to think as creatively as possible from the beginning and bring any and all claims that are available. And so that's what we did. I'll tell you the facts briefly for context, but it's essentially a lawsuit brought on behalf of, we brought on behalf of hundreds of Colombian victims whose family members were murdered or otherwise injured by the paramilitary group in Colombia that was prevalent during the late 90s and the early 2000s, which is called the AUC, the Autos Defensas Unidas de Colombia. And Chiquita Brands, which is an American company headquartered in Ohio and incorporated in New Jersey at the time, had been paying the AUC from at least 1996 onward until 2004. And in 2007, they entered into a plea agreement with the Department of Justice where they admitted to paying a foreign terrorist organization because the AUC was designated as a foreign terrorist organization in 2001. So there was actually a fine that Chiquita paid to the Department of Justice for $25 million. I believe it was 25 million, but none of that ever went to any of the victims. So that's what this case has been about. We filed in 2007 and it's gone through many permutations because we initially filed as an ATS case with CVPA claims and with foreign law Colombian claims and with state law claims. And as the Supreme Court has changed its mind or made up its mind about these different human rights federal statutes, we've seen certain claims fall away and certain claims endure. So we no longer have ATS claims, even though the facts of the Chiquita case, I think, would meet the Kiobel tests. And that's because, you know, it's a U.S. company, it's a U.S. national. There are reasons why we continue to argue that it, you know, the decision to dismiss those claims was wrong. And then the TVPA claims after the Muhammad case were no longer viable against Chiquita, but they remain against the individual executives who we also sued alongside the company. But the state law claims strangely fell away for a reason that we still do not understand, that there's kind of an outlier decision that's not in accordance with basic principles of diversity jurisdiction. But the good news is that Colombian law remains in the case. And it remains in the case against both the company and against the individual executive defendants. And I think that one of the things that I've seen through the Colombian law aspect of this case is we've been briefing this over the past few years is I would really strongly agree with Aneshka that, you know, you think that the power of these federal statutes is, you know, I don't want to downplay it. It gives you strong language. It gives you the language of human rights. And these could be powerful tools. But basic principles of negligence can also be just as strong in an aiding and abetting situation. So here you've got Chiquita and its executives knowingly paying this this paramilitary group, this formally designated as a terrorist paramilitary group, when they had the option to leave Colombia. They didn't need to keep paying them and keep doing business there. And they didn't, and they stayed, and they paid, and they knew that the group was involved in gross violations of human rights, massive massacres against civilians. And when we brought the lawsuit, we also pled Colombian law, and it turns out that Colombian law has a statute that's akin to negligence that just kind of has like a reasonable person standard and even in like a good businessman standard. So there's actually the standard that's called like the good father of the family, which is what they use as the metric for the reasonable person. And then there's the good businessman. And so we're arguing very basic principles about that they knowingly, you know, did this. They foresaw the consequences that was illegal at the time in Colombia to do this. That couldn't have been a good business practice. And the court hasn't ruled on those issues yet. But I think it shows you the power of bringing foreign law claims and keeping them in, and also the power of these basic legal principles that underpin both common law and civil law jurisdictions in many places. I'm also involved in a case called Doe v. IFC, which is a case that we brought on behalf of victims of paramilitary violence in Honduras. And it's a case we brought against the International Finance Corporation, which is a private lending arm of the World Bank Group, and because the IFC was paying a palm oil company in Honduras at the time that it was using its security forces to kill or otherwise torture campesino groups that were fighting for the same rights to occupy the land that the palm company was using to grow the palm and to expand. And in that case, we brought it under Honduran law and regular state tort law, even though it is essentially an aiding and abetting case. And we're arguing general aiding and abetting principles under the Haberstam v. Welch standard, and which is a Second Circuit decision. Oh, sorry, it's a DC Circuit decision from some years ago that some jurisdictions have taken up, but it's basically it's like a general principle of aiding and abetting, you know, knowingly providing substantial assistance and the harm is foreseeable. That shows, I think, that you can do these big human rights cases, or at least we were trying, involving paramilitary crimes. And it doesn't need to be with a federal statute like the ATS or the TVPA or some of the other we've spoken about. And also I would highlight there factually that this is a situation where the paramilitary groups in Honduras are not formally recognized. They're more operating in the shadows, and people on the ground tell you about how they're operating, but it's not like it was for the AUC, where it was already a foreign terrorist organization designated as such by the US government. So I think factually, I would also say for folks working on cases where paramilitary groups are really doing the bidding of economic and political elites who are engaged in crimes in order to extract resources or to push through mega projects or other heinous acts, I think being cognizant that paramilitary groups and these, can act through many different permutations, and that they can be, doing a lot of damage. And the documentation is really important, because if they're not formally recognized, if they're not something that's known about in international discourse, you've got a lot of factual development to do to show those linkages. And for us, community participation and documentation has been really important to show those links. I think I'm probably at time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marissa. That's all really interesting. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Mona Lisa to talk about some of the litigation she's been working on affecting people in India.
Thank you. So I'm going to be talking about Syngenta, and there's litigation happening in Switzerland, but I'm going to take you a step back and talk about what happened in India before. So this is actually really a story of four statements Syngenta made, and these are profound. Syngenta is a leading pesticide company. It is headquartered in Basel. The first one is the CEO saying in 2019, we want up to 10% of Syngenta revenue to come from India. Before the spate of poisonings happened, Syngenta was already big in the Indian pharma market. Headquartered in Basel, it's been operating in India for over 15 years, and it is headquartered in the state where the poisoning occurred in India. In 2020, Syngenta's net income was $855 million, and India provides 3% of the global revenues to Syngenta. With that background of the seller, let's look at who is the buyer and then what is the product. Syngenta's customer base in Yavatmal, which is the region, is actually the epicenter of pharma suicides in India. In a 17-year span, nearly 4,000 farmers have committed suicides. This region has experienced severe agrarian crisis, which means that there have been repeated crop failures, very high levels of indebtedness, and agriculture is just not paying the farmers anymore. Till a few years back, half the families in that region were earning less than 2 euros a day. Again, this is an agriculture-dominated economy. The product itself is an inherently dangerous product. Since 2002, the pesticide has a particular active ingredient, which is not sold in EU anymore, because EU has recognized that this is toxic on inhalation. There is organ damage with prolonged exposure. In India, it is considered moderately toxic, and in Japan, it's considered highly toxic. Syngenta knew the inherent danger of its product when it was launching it in India. Six years prior to its launch in India, the EU authorization had been withdrawn. And this was not a coincidence. The fact that Syngenta lost one market and that product was pumped in India and other developing countries. UN bodies, FAOs have recognized cases of pesticide manufacturers increasing exports of products that have been banned or restricted in their own countries, possibly in order to use up existing stocks. One of the major failures was the fact that the product does not give enough warning on its labels. Either the warning is not legible, or the way warnings are conveyed through colors, there's no appreciation for that. The warning in Hindi, which would be more applicable, is actually rather general compared to the one that is worded in English. And then obviously it helps that Syngenta recognizes that a large number of farmers are small and marginal farmers. And these are all statements that Syngenta has made, or it's there on the website. So there's a good chance that Syngenta is very well aware of the lack of literacy among farmers and the fact that they are ill-prepared to safely use this product. Now, generally, pesticide spraying requires use of protective equipment. And however, there's no generalization across the board. Those are very specific depending on the product. Not only does Syngenta twist the narrative to say that usage of personal protective equipment is low in India among farmers, which is to go into victim blaming, but it also conveniently forgets to mention that PPE is expensive, unavailable, and certainly impractical to use in tropical climates, where the heat is unbearable. At the same time, these are people who are earning less than 2 euros a day. They cannot afford PPE, at least at the level that Syngenta would expect them to use. So basically, this was the harm that was caused. But pesticide poisoning had been reported in India before also, but in the year 2017, it almost doubled from the previous year, and you had 886 patients. Judicial records showed that there were at least 65 deaths, and there were police records which showed that 80 survivors reported using Syngenta's product. However, these figures are not accurate because, again, you're looking at a population where medical care is compromised, not of good quality. A lot of people would have chosen not to go to the doctor. A lot of people would have not been included in the data that was collected. And a lot of people who died, their bodies were cremated before postmortem could be conducted, and then the reason could be found. So this is partial and not complete data. The aftermath was that there was a temporary ban that was imposed. However, because of the breakup of state and federal law, the state could only put a ban for 60 days in place. There were announcements that criminal cases would be filed against the company. Those did not materialize. There was a string of government action, including three investigations, including a special investigation team. Which is not the norm in India. It's usually a very serious matter, and you set up an SIT. A public interest litigation commenced after. So with all of this, from 2017, October, there is already a lot of media attention on the issue, and there is information about Syngenta's product Polo having been used. So, and this is how Syngenta responds. There is absolutely no evidence to suggest that Syngenta's product Polo was at all responsible for the incidents that have occurred, which is, again, you knew the market that you were going into, you knew the people you were selling the product to, you knew there was a hazardous product, and then surprise, this happened. And actually, EPA had already fined Syngenta way before for something similar that had happened, where it failed to warn workers about re-entry periods, like a particular space had been treated and then nobody was supposed to go in. And Syngenta failed to warn the workers about it. Workers went in, there was exposure. And then the next part to that was, after the fine was imposed, Syngenta waited it out for a change of administration. And once the Trump administration was in power, they could pay a lesser fine. So now what has happened is, of course, there was litigation that happened. The litigation in India is still directed towards the state because our corporate accountability standards are quite difficult, quite poor in some sense. You can still rely on consumer laws and things like that. The High Court actually did a fantastic job of opening the door for this kind of litigation and said that individuals could actually sue the companies responsible. The state was supposed to see which are the companies responsible, and then they could also sue the companies. But of course, again, we are looking at a litigation framework where it is usually the tort framework that's still used. The duration will span at least a decade for any kind of litigation to be successfully concluded. You're looking at people who are earning less than €2 a day suing a company that has $855 million in profits. So that gap speaks for itself. Currently, what has happened is the community has been very active, and they have, with the support of NGOs abroad, they have been able to bring an OECD complaint process, which is a negotiation process, and simultaneously filed a complaint in the Swiss courts on behalf of three families whose members died. So let's say at this point, I'm more optimistic about what might happen in the Swiss courts than what could happen in India.
And I wonder if all four of you could talk a little bit about, you know, community lawyering in the international context. I think students are often familiar with community lawyering in the domestic context, but we may not be as familiar or teach as much in U.S. law schools about community lawyering internationally. So I was hoping you guys could speak to that.
Sure, I could go first on that. So I think my work has always been like, can we do a local application of global international human rights standards? Can a person, a migrant worker who has come to work in the factory producing for all the brands that we are wearing right now and working for 12 hours or 16 hours and not being paid enough, can they see themselves as rights holders and want to hold this corporation accountable? That itself is a very, that's fraught with many dangers because as lawyers, we might see things from our lens, but as somebody who has two kids who they want to put through school, maybe they're not looking for a landmark judgment from your Supreme Court or just to break barriers in the international jurisprudence. So there is a lot of effort that goes into, and then the second biggest barrier that I see is the way we perceive of human rights violations. The more gory it is, the more blood it involves, the easier it is for us to sympathize, whereas to say that women workers are not paid enough or are being paid lesser than they should, to get a campaign around that is much harder depending on where you are and how many international organizations are involved. Sometimes you just don't have the kind of money you need for community lawyering. So if the approach for at least the community-based legal aid clinics that I've been with is to have that regular interaction with workers where they come up to you and they say that, okay, this is a problem. This is how I'm being treated in this factory and this is who we are producing for. What should we do? It becomes much more easier in some sense when the ownership is within the community and you are just helping them fight for their rights rather than to come with an idea that, oh, I work for this NGO. Let me make your life better. So
I think that's exactly right. And I don't think any of these cases could succeed without strong buy-in from the people on the ground, both the victims and the survivors who are affected, and also the local community of activists and people who live there. And one, you'd fail as a lawyer if you didn't help build their own capacity to navigate the next case. And you could never successfully litigate your case over the years it takes to bring it here if you didn't have strong support on the ground working with the victims and helping move the case forward and explaining it. And also really trusted interlocutors who can help you make sure that you're meeting the needs of the clients.
Definitely agree. I think that community lawyering in transnational human rights cases is really hard, but the most important thing. And I think that we have to be real with ourselves about some of the practical difficulties that arise when we're often located in different countries, when we live in very different situations and the people that we're working with, and we need to try as best as we can to meet them where they're at and to make it as co-powered as possible. I think even just like thinking of some of the technical ways you can do this is really important. When I first graduated from law school and I moved to Peru to work with Earth Rights, my colleague, Ben Hoffman, and I were trying to basically apply theories of community lawyering and movement lawyering that we learned in actually outside the human rights field, because there wasn't much going on inside the human rights academic field at the time talking about these issues. And we were just puzzling through it left and right. I mean, we realized that if you show up at a community with a retainer already printed out, like, how do you make changes, right? And shouldn't the retainer be a negotiated document that's a commitment you're making to each other that talks about what your goals are and how you're going to accomplish them? And can you bring a portable printer? You know, is this a thing you can do? Or can you, we actually now have lines in our retainer that are just kind of like blanks where the clients, the communities write in what justice would look like for them. And so we have to be real about how much harder it is when we're in different geographic locations, when you're working through technology, when in-person visits are, you know, maybe not as many as you'd like them to be. But it's so important to puzzle through them and to work through them and to be creative. And I think it's also really important to remember like that issues of power and privilege and voice are just as important and perhaps more important in this work because of this geographic distance. Outsiders coming into people's communities is always something that comes with a lot of consequences, and you just need to think about that and be conscious about it all the time. So I guess my addition here would just be that it's important. It's just so important, and you need to think about it all the time.
Yeah, I basically have not much to add, except that I've been thinking. Yeah, we've just sort of lost the case before the European Court of Human Rights at ECCHR. I have not been working on it close, but I follow it with my colleagues. And it was on representing the families of children that have been bombed in Afghanistan by bombing in 2009, which was ordered by a German general. And we represented this family in the criminal investigations against that general under international criminal law. And those people were denied everything. They didn't get access to the file because everything was privileged and so on. And so basically we went on that. We said, well, they never even had a chance to know what was investigated, what did the prosecutor, and let alone had the chance of appealing this, because you do have as a victim, you have some rights in criminal procedure. And basically they lost. They didn't get justice. Still, the court decision is... It didn't set precedence because it made a very important jurisdictional decision, which is the European Charter applies even to bombings, right? This was not a situation of factual control because it was not on, it was, there was aerial control, but not on the ground, right? So it did, you know, the in principle, protection under the European Convention has improved, but this doesn't help those families, no? And so what do you do with that? I think it's really tragic. And I think we all feel this. And it's, and it's again this. And you felt like, yeah, okay, so this has been in the media and it got attention for like 3 days or something. Big judgment. You know, you've got all the blogs, law blogs that, you know, analyze the judgment. It didn't deliver anything. I think then it was Afghanistan. I think my colleagues hardly ever, I think if they have been there once, this has been much, you know, because how do you go to rural Afghanistan in this situation, right? So then, you know, basically, well, we took the case 2009. So the question is, what is the lesson learned? Do we not take those cases? Because, you know, of course we had an interlocutor and yes. And so of course there was some sort of exchange, but there's not a real community organizing. It just wasn't possible. And then what do you do? Not do it?
I don't. Cases where the state can actually take a stand and take corporations to task, or let's say the Syngenta example that I talked about. It's just, we're all in that kind of compromised democracy. So.
There's a question that I love in the chat, which is, in your wildest dreams, if there's community organizing around this issue, what are you hoping will be the best litigation or best legislation that you could get out of this?
You know, Kathy, but I think in our courts, it's jurisdiction and extraterritoriality. And it's not the, right, the flash. I'm not a huge fan of the due diligence legislation. I think it will end up like with what Miriam said, is that you'll have, at least here in America, we'll have bogus standards and a safe harbor, and it will shield companies and not actually result in any sort of forward progress or better work. But it, here, like, we have real problems with getting jurisdiction because it's been so narrowed. And you're kind of ending up in a situation where you can't sue someone here or there. And there's like law-free zone is apparently where we're headed. And the notion that you can't hold American companies and American citizens to account if they commit horrible acts overseas seems crazy to me. Like, this extraterritoriality obsession is bad. Like, you ought to be able to hold people to account in the place where they live and are found and do business.
I would add to that, that forum non conveniens is such a problem, because if you're bringing state law claims and not a federal statute, your biggest obstacle is likely to be either statute of limitations or forum non conveniens. If I could like snap my fingers and change one thing right now in the US courts, it would be that I think the rule should be, especially after personal jurisdiction has changed in the US Supreme Court in the Goodyear and Bauman Daimler Chrysler cases, that a company that is sued where it's incorporated or headquartered cannot invoke FNC, because the Supreme Court has narrowed general personal jurisdiction and said, these are the two places that a US company can be sued on any and all claims. And then they're able to win on forum non conveniens. We just had this happen in a case that I have been litigating for years against Newmont Mining Company, which is incorporated in Delaware, but headquartered in Colorado and has been involved in allegedly been involved in using security forces against a campesina family in Peru that's basically trying to stay on their land, and they're sitting on top of a $5 billion gold mine that Newmont wants to build. And even though we'd presented evidence that Newmont had been involved in past scandals paying Peruvian courts for certain outcomes, and that this should have raised a serious question about the adequacy of the Peruvian forum, they were still able to get FNC to Peru, and that was upheld on appeal 2 months ago. And it just seems outrageous to me that a US company, after the changes that have been made at the Supreme Court to personal jurisdiction, can still invoke FNC when it's being sued where it's incorporated. So this is a bone I have to pick. Maybe one day I'll change FNC law. Probably not. People are skeptical, but this, if I could snap my fingers, that's what I would do.
The law I would envision would have a very wide sort of to make basically all human, I'm not sure if I would frame it as a tort law claim, but basically I think turning all the rights guaranteed by the, you know, by the big covenants and the most important human rights versions should be protected as rights that give you, you know, the ability to sue. And then I guess, And then the questions you could, and then there should be a wider range of remedies. So one, I think there must be civil litigation. So you somehow must be constructing this as tort. So, you know, I've been involved in this debate on how would we actually want the due diligence law to look like. And we started to think about this before due diligence was a topic. So, and then sort of to be saying, okay, but, you know, you need to have this wide range of violations that you have, and then you should attach civil liability to it. And there, I think the most important thing is to clarify what are the duties of care if you want to stay in sort of more in a torts, you know, way of arguing, or if you want to talk it in criminal words, you know, how do you establish contribution? What are the standards? And I think this whole thing of, you know, jumping the divide and I don't think it's necessary piercing the corporate veil, but it's sort of creating duties at the headquarters, I think is important. And then if you think this more in terms of duty of care, you're not going into this due diligence thing. But then also we've been thinking, so really in an ideal world is sort of, it's a bit like you, so either you choose between criminal law and then, you know, you get someone else go to jail. Or you get, if you choose a civil route, then you get compensation. But, you know, I think a lot of times pecuniary, like money, compensation in money. And I, you know, I think that sometimes people want something different, no? If they enter into justice and reparation means something else. But we can't, you know, how do you, I think this is something courts should be able to order other means than just saying, you know, we're putting a number on the damage that has been done, no? But anyways, that's very far away.
In addition to everything that's been said, I would really like to see justice being accessible for the people in the sense where, let's just talk about evidence, for instance. It's so hard to get something from one jurisdiction admitted into another. And if your jurisdiction, if your witness is relying on a medical record from a government hospital in some small town or a village in India, the fact that this should actually lead to compensation, it's just impossible to meet those standards. So I would make that part easier. I also feel that if your business is premised on a model which relies on exploitation in an economy or a country where the same rules do not apply, and if it enables you to engage in this hypocrisy, I would take that out. I would address that. Like, why Vietnam, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, India for apparel is just because the legal system is so broken. So I would want that to be addressed with whatever that magical piece of legislation is. And secondly, Kathy, because you said about how discouraging this is, but look how encouraging this is. Look at all the amazing litigation that's happening. And despite all the challenges, I mean, the brilliant work that people are doing. So optimism.
I think that's a great note to wrap up on. So I have to say, it's been really inspiring to talk to you all. The really inspiring thing is that there are all these people out here doing this work. And for the students watching, that you too can get involved in doing amazing community lawyering that doesn't have to be limited to the boundaries of your country, but can in fact be a part of a global community where we're uplifting the voices of workers and other marginalized groups. With that, I think we'll wrap up the panel.
You can find the Promise Institute on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Be sure to check out the Promise Institute blog and sign up for our newsletter for updates on events and goings-on in the world of human rights law. Thank you for rating and reviewing the podcast. It means a lot to us and helps others find the podcast. Have a great day.